all of them high-born ladies and attendants to the Queen. Lucinda Penrose, she who had been attacked whilst hawking before the Maiden's Day ball, admitted to wanting Daenerys dead, saying, "If my nose had not been slit, it would be her serving me, not me serving her. No man will have me now because of her." Cassandra Baratheon confessed that she had often shared her bed with Sir Mervyn Flowers, and sometimes at Sir Mervyn's behest with Tessario the Tiger, but only when he asked it of me. When Willem Stackspear suggested that perhaps she was part of the reward the Volantine had been promised, Lady Cassandra burst into tears. Yet even her confession paled beside that of Lady Priscilla Hogg, a sad and somewhat simple girl of 14, stout and short and plain of face, who had somehow conceived the notion that Prince Viserys would marry her if only Lyra of Lys were dead. "He smiles whenever he sees me," she told the court, "and once when he passed me on the steps, his shoulder brushed against my bosom." Lord Manderley, Grand Maester Monken, and the regents questioned the three women closely, mayhaps, as Mushroom avers, trying to elicit the name of a fourth woman hitherto unmentioned, Lady Clarice Osgrey, widowed aunt of Lord Unwin Peak. Lady Clarice supervised all Queen Daenerys' maids, companions, and attendants, as she did Queen Jaehaerys' ladies before them, and was well acquainted with many of the confessed conspirators. Mushroom says that she and George Graceford were lovers, and suggests that her ladyship was so aroused by torture that she sometimes joined the Lord Confessor in the dungeons to assist him with his work. If she had been involved, it was likely Unwin Peak had as well. All their probing proved to no avail, however, and when Lord Torren asked bluntly whether Lady Clarice had been complicit, all three of the condemned women could only shake their heads. Though unquestionably part of the conspiracy, the roles played by the three women had been comparatively minor. For that reason, and on account of their sex, Lord Manderley and the regents chose to show them mercy. Lucinda Penrose and Priscilla Hogg were condemned to have their noses cut off, with the understanding that the punishment would be stayed should they give themselves to the faith, so long as they remained true to their vows. Cassandra Baratheon's high birth spared her the same punishment. She was, after all, the late Lord Boris's eldest child and sister to the present Lord of Storm's End, and had once been betrothed to King Aegon II. Though her mother, Lady Alendra, was not well enough to attend the trials, she had sent three of her son's bannermen to speak for Storm's End. Through them, and Lord Grandison, whose lands and keep were also of the Stormlands, it was arranged for Lady Cassandra to wed a minor knight named Sir Walter Brownhill, who ruled a few hides of land on Cape Wrath from a castle oft described as being made of mud and tree roots. Thrice bereft, Sir Walter had fathered 16 children by his previous wives, 13 of whom still lived. It was Lady Alendra's thought that caring for these children, and any additional sons or daughters that she herself might give Sir Walter, would keep Lady Cassandra from plotting any further treasons. And so it did. This concluded the last of the treason trials, but the dungeons beneath the Red Keep had not as yet been emptied. The fate of Lady Lara's brothers, Lotho and Rogerio, remained to be decided. Though innocent of high treason, murder, and conspiracy, they still stood accused of fraud and theft. The collapse of the Regari Bank had led to the ruination of thousands, in Westeros as well as Lys. Though bound to House Targaryen through marriage, the brothers were neither kings nor princes themselves, and their lordships were but empty courtesies, Lord Manderley and Grand Maester Monken agreed. They would be tried and punished. In this, the Seven Kingdoms lagged well behind the Free City of Lys, where the collapse of the Regari Bank had led inexorably to the utter ruin of the house that Lysandro the Magnificent had built. The palace he had bequeathed to his daughter Lysara was seized, together with the manses of his other children and all their furnishings. A handful of Draco Regari's trading galleys learned of the house's fall in time to divert course to Volantis. But for every ship saved, 9 were lost, together with their cargoes and the Regari wharves and storehouses. Lady Lysara was deprived of her gold, gems, and gowns, Lady Mara of her books. Fredo Regari saw the Magisters seize the perfumed garden, even as he tried to sell it. His slaves were sold, along with those of his siblings, true-born or bastard. When that proved insufficient to pay more than a tenth of the debts left by the bank's collapse, the Ragaris themselves were sold into slavery, together with their children. The daughters of Fredo and Lysaro, Ragare, would soon find themselves back in the perfumed garden, where they had played as children, but as bed-slaves, not proprietors. Nor did Lysaro Ragare, architect of his family's doom, escape unscathed. He and his eunuch guards were captured in the town of Volontheris on the Rhine, as they were waiting for a boat to carry them across the river. Loyal to the end, the Unsullied died to a man fighting to protect him, but only 20 remained with him. Lysaro had taken 100 when he fled from Lys, but had been forced to sell most of them along the way, and they soon found themselves hemmed in and surrounded in the confused, bloody fighting by the docks. Once taken, Lysaro was sent downriver to Volantis, where the Triarchs offered him to his brother Draco for a certain price. Draco declined and suggested the Volantines sell him back to Lys instead. And so Lysaro Ragare was returned to Lys, chained to an oar in the belly of a Volantine slave ship. During his trial, when asked what he had done with all the gold that he had stolen, Lysaro laughed and began to point to certain magisters in the assembly, saying, "I used it to bribe him, and him, and him, and him," picking out a dozen men before he could be silenced. It did not save him. The men he had bought voted with the rest to condemn him, and kept the bribes as well, for the magisters of Lys put avarice ahead of honour, as is well known. Lysaro was sentenced to be chained naked to a pillar before the Temple of Trade, where all those despoiled by him would be allowed to whip him, the number of lashes accorded to each person to be determined by the extent of their losses. And so it was done. It is written that his sister Lysara and brother Fredo were amongst those who availed themselves of the whip, whilst other Lysini placed wagers on the hour of his death. Lysaro expired in the 7th hour of the 1st day of his scourging. His bones would remain chained to the pillar for 3 years, until his brother Moredo pulled them down and interred them in the family crypt. In this instance, at the least, Lysine justice proved to be considerably harsher than that of the Seven Kingdoms. Many in Westeros would gladly have seen Lotho and Rogerio Ragare suffer the same dire fate as Lysaro, for the collapse of the Ragare Bank had impoverished great lords and humble tradesmen alike. But even those who most despised them could offer no shred of proof that either had known of their brother's depredations in Lys, or had benefited from his plundering in any way. In the end, the banker Lotho was adjudged guilty of theft, for taking gold and gems and silver not his own, and failing to restore same on demand. Lord Manderley gave him the choice of taking the black, or having his right hand removed as if he were a common thief. "Then praise Indros! I am left-handed," Lotho said, choosing mutilation. Nothing at all could be proved against his brother, Rogerio, but Lord Manderley sentenced him to 7 lashes all the same. "For what?" Rogerio demanded of him, aghast. "For being a thrice-damned Lysini," Torrin Manderley responded. After the sentences had been carried out, both of the brothers left King's Landing. Rogerio closed his brothel, selling off the building, the carpets, drapes, beds, and other furnishings, even the parrots and the monkeys, using the coin thus gained to buy himself a ship, a great cog he named the Mermaid's Daughter. Thus was his pillow house reborn, this time with sails. For years to come, Rogerio sailed up and down the narrow sea, selling spiced wine, exotic viands, and carnal pleasure to the denizens of great ports and humble fishing villages alike. His brother Lotho, shorter hand, was taken up by Lady Samantha, the paramour of Lord Lionel Hightower, and returned with her to Oldtown. The Hightowers had not entrusted so much as a groat of their gold to the Lysini, and thus remained one of the wealthiest houses in all Westeros, second, mayhaps, only to the Lannisters of Casterly Rock. And Lady Sam wished to learn how to put that gold to better use. Thus was born the Bank of Oldtown, which has made House Hightower richer still. Moredo Rogare, the eldest of the three brothers who had come with Lady Laura to King's Landing, was in Braavos during the trials, treating with the keyholders of the Iron Bank. Before the year was out, he would sail for Tyrosh, flush with Braavos Sea Gold, to hire ships and swords for an attack on Lys. That is a tale for another time, however, beyond our current purview. King Aegon III did not once appear to sit the Iron Throne during the trials of the brothers, but Prince Viserys came every day to sit beside his wife. What Lara of Lys thought of the Hand's justice neither Mushroom nor the court chronicles can tell us, save to note that she wept when Lord Torren handed down his verdict. Soon thereafter the lords began to depart, each to their own seat, and life resumed as before in King's Landing under the new regents and King's Hand, though more the latter than the former. The gods chose our new regents, Mushroom observed, and it would seem that gods are just as thick as lords. He was not wrong. Lord Stackspear loved to hawk, Lord Merryweather loved to feast, and Lord Grandison loved to sleep, and each man thought the other two were fools. But in the end it made no matter, for Torren Manderly proved to be an honest and able hand, of whom it was rightly said that he was brusque and gluttonous, but fair. King Aegon never warmed to him, it is true, but his grace did not have a trusting nature, and the events of the past year had only served to deepen his suspicions. Nor could Lord Torren be said to have had much regard for the king, whom he referred to as that sullen boy when writing to his daughter in White Harbour. Manderly did become fond of Prince Viserys, however, and doted on Queen Daenerys. Though the Northman's regency was comparatively short, it was far from uneventful. With the considerable help of the gilded falcon Isambard Arryn, Manderly enacted a major reform of the taxes, providing more income for the crown and some relief for those who could prove they had suffered losses from the plundering of the Rogare Bank. With the Lord Commander, he brought the King's Guard up to 7 once again, bestowing white cloaks upon Sir Edmund Warwick, Sir Dennis Whitfield, and Sir Agrimore Cobb, to fill the places of Marston Waters, Mervyn Flowers, and Amory Peak. He formally repudiated the pact that Alan Oakenfist had signed to secure the release of Prince Viserys, on the grounds that the agreement had been made not with the free city of Lys, but with House Rogare, which could no longer be said to exist. With Sir Gareth Long upon the wall, the Red Keep had need of a new master-at-arms. Lord Manderly appointed a fine young swordsman named Sir Lucas Lothston. The grandson of a hedge knight, Sir Lucas was a patient teacher who soon became a favourite with Prince Viserys, and even won a certain grudging respect from King Aegon. For Lord Confessor, Manderly tapped Maester Rowley, a fresh-faced youth newly arrived from Old Town, where he had studied under Archmaester Sandeman, reputedly the wisest healer in the history of Westeros. It was Grand Maester Munken who urged that Rowley be appointed. A man who knows how to ease pain will also know how to inflict it, he told the Hand. But it is also important that we have a Lord Confessor who sees his work as duty, not pleasure. On the eve of Smith's Day, Lara of Lys gave Prince Viserys a second son, a large and lusty boy that the prince named Aemon. A feast was held to celebrate, and all rejoiced at the birth of this new prince, save mayhaps for his year-and-a-half-old brother Aegon, who was discovered hitting the babe with a dragon's egg that had been placed inside the cradle. No harm was done, for Aemon's howls soon brought Lady Lara running to disarm and discipline her elder son. Soon thereafter, Lord Alan Oakenfist grew restless and began to make plans for the second of his 6 great voyages. The Valerians had entrusted much of their gold to Lotho Rogare and lost more than half their wealth in consequence. To restore their fortunes, Lord Alan assembled a large fleet of merchantmen with 12 of his war galleys to guard them, intending to sail to Old Volantis by way of Pentos, Tyrosh, and Lys, visiting Dawn on the way home. It is said that he and his wife quarrelled before the voyage, for Lady Bela was of the blood of the dragon and quick to anger, and had heard too much talk from her lord husband about Princess Aleandra of Dawn. Yet in the end they reconciled, as they always did. The fleet set sail at mid-year, led by Oakenfist in a galley he named Bold Marilda, after his mother. Lady Baylor remained on Driftmark with Lord Alyn's second child growing inside her. The king's 16th name day was drawing near. With the realm at peace and spring in full flower, Lord Torrhen Manderly decided that King Aegon and Queen Daenerys should make a royal progress to mark his coming of age. It would be good for the boy to see the lands he ruled, the Hand reasoned, to show himself to his people. Aegon was tall and comely, and his sweet young queen could supply whatever charm the king might lack. The commons would surely love her, which could only be of benefit to the solemn young king. The regents concurred. Plans were made for a grand progress lasting a full year, one that would take his grace to parts of the realm that had never seen a king before. From King's Landing they would ride to Duskendale and Maidenpool, and thence take ship for Gulltown. After a visit to the Eyrie, they would return to Gulltown and sail for the north, with a stop at the Three Sisters. White Harbour would give the king and queen a welcome such as they had never seen, Lord Manderly promised. Then they could continue north to Winterfell, perhaps even visit the Wall, before turning south again, down the King's Road to the Neck. Sabbatha Frey would host them at the Twins. They would call upon Lord Benjicott at Raventree Hall. And, of course, if they visited the Blackwoods, they must needs spend the same amount of time with the Brackens. A few nights at River Run, and they would cross over the hills into the west to visit Lady Joanna at Casterly Rock. From there it would be down the sea road to the Reach, Highgarden, Goldengrove, Old Oak. There was a dragon at Red Lake. Aegon would not like that, but Red Lake was easily avoided. A visit at one of Unwin Peak's seats might help assuage the former hand. At Old Town, the High Septon himself could no doubt be persuaded to give the king and queen his blessing, and Lord Lionel and Lady Sam would welcome the chance to show the king that the splendours of their city far outshone those of King's Landing. "It will be a progress such as the realm has not seen in more than a century," a grand Maester Monken told his grace. "Spring is a time for new beginnings, sire, and this will mark the true beginning of your reign. From the Dornish marches to the Wall, all will know you for their king, and Daenerys for their queen." Torrhen Manderly agreed. "It will do the lad some good to get out of this bloody castle," he declared in Mushroom's hearing. "He can hunt and hawk, climb a mountain or two, fish for salmon in the White Knife, see the Wall, feasts every night. It would not harm the boy to put some flesh on those bones of his. Let him try some good northern ale, so thick you can cut it with a saw." Preparations for the king's name-day celebrations, and the royal progress to follow, consumed all of the attention of the Hand and the three regents in the days that followed. Lists of those lords and knights wishing to accompany the king were drawn up, torn up, and drawn up again. Horses were shod, armour polished, wagons and wheelhouses repaired and repainted, banners sewn. Hundreds of ravens flew back and forth across the Seven Kingdoms, as every lord and landed knight in Westeros begged the honour of a royal visit. Lady Rhaena's desire to accompany the progress on her dragon was delicately deflected, whilst her sister Baylor declared that she would come along whether she was wanted or not. Even the clothing that the king and queen would wear came in for careful thought. On the days when Queen Daenerys wore green, it was decided, Aegon would be clad in his customary black. But when the little queen wore the red and black of House Targaryen, the king would don a green cloak, so both colours would be seen wherever they might go. A few matters were still under discussion when King Aegon's name day dawned at last. A great feast was to be held that night in the throne room, and the ancient Guild of Alchemists had promised displays of pyromancy such as the realm had never seen. It was still morning, though, when King Aegon entered the council chambers where Lord Torrhen and the regents were debating whether or not to include Tumbleton on the progress. Four knights of the king's guard accompanied the young king to the council chambers. So did Sandok the Shadow, veiled and silent, carrying his great sword. His ominous presence cast a pall in the room. For a moment even Torrhen Manderly lost his tongue. "Lord Manderly," King Aegon said in the sudden stillness, "pray tell me how old I am, if you would be so good." "You are 10 and 6 today, your grace," Lord Manderly replied. "A man grown. It is time for you to take the governance of the Seven Kingdoms into your own hands."
"I shall,"
King Aegon said.
You are sitting in my chair.
The coldness in his tone took every man in the room aback, Grand Maester Monken would write years later. Confused and shaken, Torrin Manderley prized his considerable bulk out of the chair at the head of the council table, with an uneasy glance at Sandok the Shadow. As he held the chair for the king, he said, "Your Grace, we were speaking of the progress."
"There will be no progress,"
the king declared as he was seated. "I will not spend a year upon a horse, sleeping in strange beds and trading empty courtesies with drunken lords, half of whom would gladly see me dead if it gained them a groat. If any man requires words with me, he will find me on the Iron Throne." Torrin Manderley persisted. "Sire," he said, "this progress would do much and more to win you the love of the small folk." "I mean to give the small folk peace and food and justice. If that will not suffice to win their love, let Mushroom make a progress. Or perhaps we might send a dancing bear. Someone once told me that the commons love nothing half so much as dancing bears. You may call a halt to this feast tonight as well. Send the lords home to their own keeps and give the food to the hungry. Full bellies and dancing bears shall be my policy." Then Aegon turned to the three regents. "Lord Stackspear, Lord Grandison, Lord Merryweather, I thank you for your service. Consider yourselves free to go. I shall have no further need of regents." "And will your grace have need of a hand?" asked Lord Manderley.
"A king should have a hand of his own choosing," said Aegon the Third, rising to his feet. "You have served me well, no doubt, as you served my mother before me. But it was my lords who chose you. You may return to White Harbour."
"Gladly, sire," said Manderley, in a voice the Grand Maester Monken would later call a growl. "I have not drunk a decent ale since coming to this cesspit of a castle." Whereupon he removed his chain of office and set it on the council table. Less than a fortnight later, Lord Manderley took ship for White Harbour with a small entourage of sworn swords and servants, amongst them Mushroom. The fool had grown fond of the big Northman, it would seem, and had eagerly accepted his offer of a place at White Harbour rather than remain with a king who seldom smiled and never laughed. "I was a fool, but never such a fool as to stay with that fool," he tells us. The dwarf would come to outlive the young king that he abandoned. The later volumes of his testimony, filled with colourful accounts of his life in White Harbour, his sojourn at the court of the Sea Lord of Braavos, his voyage to the port of Ibbon, and his years amongst the mummers of the Lisping Lady, are valuable in their own right, though less useful to our purpose here. So, sadly, the little man with the foul tongue must pass from our story. Though never the most reliable of chroniclers, the dwarf spoke truths no one else dared speak, and was often droll besides. Mushroom tells us that the cog that Lord Manderley and his party sailed upon was called the Jolly Salt, but the mood aboard the ship was far from jolly as they beat north toward White Harbour. Torrin Manderley had never liked that sullen boy, as his letters to his daughters make clear, nor would he ever forgive the king for the brusque manner of his dismissal, or the way his grace murdered the royal progress, whose abrupt end his lordship took for a deeply humiliating personal affront. Within moments of taking the governance of the Seven Kingdoms into his own hands, King Aegon the Third had made an enemy of a man who had been amongst his most leal and devoted servants. And thus did the rule of the regents come whimpering to an end, as the broken reign of a broken king began.
This is Simon Vance. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Fire and Blood by George R. R. Martin. This program was produced and directed by Laura Wilson and engineered by Jeff Ames. Text copyright 2018 by George R. R. Martin. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.